Hello, welcome to our rebooted series, Grapples and Oranges, a candid conversation between therapists and a seasoned hand analyst on irony, personal growth, and the pursuit of purpose and meaning in life. My name is Robin, and I'm a licensed therapist. And with me today is Richard Unger, the founder and director, the founder too, huh? The founder
I
and
found it. I
director.
found it.
You found it, and now you direct it. Of the International Institute of Hand Analysis. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Robin. I was just checking the date. Today is September 26th, 2024. And
Well,
for posterity's sake, I like to say when things are, and it's always interesting to me on my own when I hear me talking 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, etc. What an interesting fellow that was then.
what interesting times he was living in.
Exactly.
So, what do you want to talk about tonight, Richard?
So the topic is action and accountability. I have notes. I know where we're going, or at least I think I know where we're going. I know where I'm going. I have no idea where you're going.
I'm
Let me
along for
ask
your
you.
ride.
Let me ask you. So, action and accountability. Does that have anything to do with therapy in any possible way?
Oh my goodness, yes. Oh my goodness, yes.
So what's
How
the
can you know
therapist?
what your
What's the therapist's point of view? What's your specific point of view? How often does action and accountability work its way into your relationship with your clients? And what can people not in therapy with you glean from your experiences?
Action and accountability comes into play after we've gotten to know each other a little bit and the issues have become clear, at least to me. And I think it's a very useful tool. Without action and accountability, I don't think that my clients could find what is standing in their way of attaining goals that they have. And not just goals out in the world, but interpersonal goals.
So, can you make that real? Can you give an example without violating the confidence of Mary Smith?
Sure. Okay.
Oh, did I
Yes.
mention her name? My mistake.
There's not very many Mary Smiths in the world. Probably just gave her away. So I have a client who works in a bar and gets unwanted attention from the opposite gender quite a bit and has really had a hard time struggling with that. And so we started an action and accountability where our the client will say one thing to one guest a night that is a standing up for themselves boundary. And so far it's worked. Except for one time. And so when that person came back and talked to me that one time, we figured out what it was that stood in their way and then focused and processed on that a little bit. And then they were able to do it again the next time they were at work.
Okay, so the issue, correct me if I'm wrong, the issue was boundary skills.
Boundary.
And in effect, after whatever number of sessions, your client walked away with a homework to do. And
Right.
they
That's the
did,
action portion.
right. So, this is not the only client that's ever walked away with homework, correct?
Not if I could help it.
And so sometimes they do what the homework is. You know, they tell person X such and such. That would be a boundary communications thing. And then, or they didn't, either way. And then they come back and see you again because it's Tuesday at 10 or whatever their standing appointment is. And then you discuss, no matter what transpired, it doesn't even matter whether they did a good job or a no job or a bad job. You have material to work with there, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Because if
So
they did
tell
do
me
it,
how
then
you
we
do.
talk.
Yeah, so tell me how you do. What do you do with that?
So if they were successful in what they set out to achieve, then we talk about how that felt and, really focus on the positive outcome of what they did and validate and cheer on the nerves that they had and the anxiety, but they did it anyway. And then we try to build on that. That's usually the action is like the smallest step possible in whatever they're working with. And then we build on it and maybe take it a step further. And then when we get to a place where they aren't able to do it because we took a step too far, then we'll just back up again and figure out what's up.
Okay, so I have a point to make about this, but I'm going to tangent myself on the way there.
Tangent away. By the way, your tangents are really good.
I like my tangents, and welcome to the podcast on tangents. So, because of my mathematical background, so, this is a baby steps tangent because. You ask a client to do something, and what might seem like eminently doable could still turn out to be too much for Mary Smith. It might not be too much for you, and it might not be too much for Mary Smith a year from now, but right now, Mary just finds herself not doing it. So, in my tangent, there was a newscaster, News at Noon woman. Who announced to the entire world that she was going to go to the gym, she was going to go on a diet, she was going to lose 10 pounds. And me, as a News at Noon consumer, was wondering where the 10 pounds would come off because she was already, model, Hollywood model, beautiful, but she was intent on losing those 10 pounds. Okay. So we're finding out the story that I'm telling, we're finding this out a year and a half after. The initiation of her diet and exercise program, and she has lost 10 pounds. But here's a story. The cameraman comes to her door at 7 a.m. the next morning to bring her to the gym, and she says she can't go. And he says, "What? You don't feel good? What's up?" "No," she says, "I'm too fat. It's too embarrassing. I'm not going to the gym." And he sweet talks her, he cajoles her, he yells at her, but she's not budging. And he comes up with an offer. "Listen, get in the van. I'll drive you to the gym. You stay in the van. When you tell the listeners at noon today, you can just tell them you went to the gym. You won't be lying. You went to the gym. You didn't go in, but you went." And okay, amidst her tears, she was able to go to the gym. This was 6 weeks she didn't get out of the van. She finally got the nerve to get out of the van, went into the gym, but didn't do anything. She walked in the front door, turned around, and walked back. That lasted a couple of more weeks. But you know what? It's now a year and a half later. She eventually got on her diet, did her exercise program. She eventually is having the 18 months later, here I am, the slenderized me. So I use this story or things like it sometimes with clients when we're dealing with something that feels very confrontive to them, whether it seems confrontive in an objective sense or not, it is confrontive to them apparently. And my point is, it doesn't matter how big a step the first step is. It's just a step. If what the homework was too big, if you couldn't do what we talked about last week, let's cut that in half. Let's cut that in quarters. What size step can you take? Can you write in your diary about not taking this step? That's a step too.
That's a step.
And maybe they can do that step. And can they come back next week and report that they had action and accountability? They wrote about not taking the step. That's not so bad. I have a different perspective because I'm not a therapist. I'm a hand reader, and I work with people about their life purpose and life lessons, which are printed in their fingerprints before they're born, as you know very well, since you studied with me for years, and read a gazillion hands as well. And I'm talking to somebody about whatever, the same issue that you were saying for what was it, Mary Smith, right? And if the issue is circumstantial, she has a particularly difficult mother or father, a particularly difficult spouse or child or whatever. She has difficulty with protecting her boundaries in general, but she has a real issue with this particular person. That's possible. But very often, I find the issue was in their fingerprints before they were born. Imagine that boundary issues, by the way, is boundary issues a rare issue to find in somebody's fingerprints, Robin?
No, it'd be rare to not find it.
it's a common enough, it's not universal, but it's a common enough issue. There's lots of different possible life lessons that the fingerprints can reveal. And, you know, this is a common enough one that we have multiple classes on what to do about this. And one of the messages that I have is, if it's in your fingerprints, it's going to show up in your life. And yes, if I was a clinical psychologist, you're not one, but if I was a clinical psychologist, I might say, well, this occurrence when I was 3 years old, 5 years old, in kindergarten or whatever, plus the incident with my mommy, blah, 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 was the precipitating cause of this this challenge that I'm facing, this difficulty, this this pain that I've been carrying around. And
I don't have to be a clinical psychologist to tell you that. I tell people that all the time.
Yeah, but you're not clinical psychologists have a different attitude.
Definitely.
Yeah, they have a different orientation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in my understanding and in my contact with clinical psychologists, earlier causes are what constitutes the reason for current behaviors. The stuff that happened to you, and then your reaction, and then whatever you build up on top of that reaction, that's what we're dealing with. So let's go back to the original cause if we can get there, or at least that's the understanding that they bring in, at least in my contact with them. And I know you have a much broader view on how people are the way they are and what they do. So back
Although to it is based back there, but yes, go ahead.
And so to complete my point on this, if it was in your fingerprints before you're born, the incidents are not written in your fingerprints before you're born, and they could very well reinforce what I'm seeing. But if I'm seeing it in your fingerprints, it wasn't actually caused by what happened when you were 3 years old, 5 years old, and 7 years old. It was already there, and the incident poked at it and opened the door for that part of you to come out and be seen. And part of the action and accountability is to recognize that when that issue comes forward, can you own your own story making about it? So one form of accountability is learning how to, well, in the example you were given before, she said so-and-so to this person and stood up for herself. That's a skill set that one learns by trial and error and through support, assistance from those who know more than you do about the issue that's difficult for you, et cetera. Practice, practice, practice. But there's another layer of that from the hand analysis perspective, which is that in stuff that's marked in the fingerprints, there's no way that stuff is not going to happen. If you grew up in a different continent with different parents, had a better skill set or whatever, it shows up again anyway, because it's you carry your fingerprints everywhere. It shows up no matter what you do, the issue arrives in your life. How you handle it, and even more specifically, what you make it mean about you is up to you. But you're not keeping that issue from arriving in your life. And that's a very different view from especially the clinical, as long as the clinical psychologist got in here, and whoever she might be, she's not here to say otherwise. I'll just characterize her for my own personal experiences. And that's a different form of accountability. In a standard idea of accountability, you do something wrong and then you apologize, you fix it, you try again, or you do better this time, something like that. You own the mistake, and then you apologize if necessary and fix it, or try again to do it better. And yeah, that's true too. But ironically, focusing on the irony factor, ironically, screwing up dealing with the issue is just as useful when the person comes back and reports to me. You screwed up. Let's see if we can freeze frame the action and catch you at the moment of screwing up, and see if in that same moment we can catch you making up a story about how the screw up happened. That's not the real story. And let's also look even deeper to see what you think that means about who you are. So screwing up is that I have exercises I do with people, as you well know, because you've done them with me, where the whole idea is to set something up so that the client does screw up, or is likely to screw up, and can they report back on their screw up? The screw up was the point. I was expecting you to screw up. What? Yeah. And screwing up wasn't bad. That was great. We caught you, and the videotape, I guess I'm in the past. The recording of your screw up is now available for us to watch in slow motion. Without
defensiveness.
Yeah. It's like we slowed it down. We're looking at your return of serve. We're just looking at it in slow motion to see where your elbow is, et cetera, so you can practice
your
tennis game.
Right. And thus it's not useful to not tell the truth about how, what story you made up.
Well, let me ask you this, therapist woman. Do people in therapy with you lie to you about what they did and what happened?
Richard, my clients tell me that I have a face, and the face is, I don't believe a thing you're saying. You're full of shit. Tell me the truth.
Well, see, that's the FOS face.
FOS?
Well, you said it yourself, the full of shit face.
Oh, the full of shit. Yes, yes, exactly. Yes. And so, yeah, of course they lie. And a lot of, you know, it has to be safe to tell the truth. There has to be no judgment, no critique, no defensiveness, nothing. It's just, this is the reality of the situation. Aren't we glad we figured this out? Now we can move forward.
So that's why you pick them up by their lapels, shake them so that the coins in their pocket, if they have, fall out, throw them against the wall, and threaten their very life if they lie again. Is that your tactic?
I have a deal with the people downstairs for me that if I shake my clients out the window and any change falls, we split the difference.
So you know that I was a financial planner. That's the job I quit to do this full time a gazillion years ago. And I would go out to people's homes or to people's businesses. And part of my job was to take a financial statement, you know, assets, liabilities. Do you have income from an annuity? Blah, 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 blah. You know, until I can have a workup as to the current financial circumstance. And then, you know, here's the goals. Without an accurate statement of where they are, how can I recommend what the next step should be? Not only that, it's required by the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission. I have to fill in a form if I sell them this financial vehicle or that one, which says I've taken all that information. So one might think that since I'm just a stranger in a suit and tie back then, I'm just arriving at their house in a very polite fashion, you know, and they're bringing me a cup of tea or something. We're sitting at the kitchen table. You would think that they would tell me the truth about their finances. And I found that that was less than half the people. It would take two, sometimes three meetings before I got the Oh yeah, we do own property in Nevada. I didn't mention that. Oh yes, and my husband owns three boats. What?
The first time you told me that, I was just stunned. Like, why do you lie to your financial planner? And what? That doesn't make sense at all. I mean, I get lying to your therapist, but your financial.
Well, for one, if the guy has a boat that the wife doesn't know and he's using it for fill in the blank, whatever your
Fill
therapist
in whatever
imagination.
the else
Wait,
the wife doesn't know.
use your therapist imagination. So that's one
Exactly.
reason. But people just fudge. So I was watching a movie a few weeks ago, and there's a character that we've been following. So we've watched him do this, that, and the other thing. And then he's talking to somebody, and the guy said, "So how did such and such go?" And he told him something that wasn't true, wasn't really lying so much, but he was avoiding telling him anything about the circumstances. And we know because we watched the circumstance happen as the watcher of the movie. And the other character says, "Why do you do that?" And he says, "What? You obfuscate, you hide, you don't reveal. What's that about?" And the character, I was impressed with this. The character thinks for a second and goes, "I don't know." He's admitting to doing it. We've seen him do it with other characters who didn't call him on it earlier in the movie. But he goes, "I don't know." I thought that was an interesting writer's touch. Whoever is writing the dialogue for the movie had to be, I don't know, super tuned in to write dialogue that included that.
Do you want to know an excellent therapist follow-up for the I don't know?
Well, we're having a discussion and you're to talk the therapist perspective. So
That's
please
my
do.
role.
Yeah,
When my client
please
says, I don't know, I say, well, do you have a theory?
do.
And they say, I'd have to think about it. And I say, I have time.
Let's think together.
Let's think about it. What do you think good theories would be? Because then it puts what I've noticed is that a client feels like they have to be right. So if you say, why'd you do that? Oftentimes a client's reluctant to answer because they might get it wrong. So if you ask what your theory would be, we're just shooting in the dark and seeing what's up. And generally their theory is the exact reason why.
If you had to
Because,
guess.
right, if you had to guess. Because then because their brain knows why.
Okay. So our topic is action and accountability. So as a therapist, do you require, is require the right word? Do you require action on the part of your clients? Can they talk over and over again about how their mother this or their father that? Or do you say, well, I'd like you to, what do you think about doing this and that regarding the circle? And do you ask them to take action?
Well, yeah, I mean, if they're not taking action, then what? I won't let them stay in therapy with me.
Oh, so that is part of therapy the way you do it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I should back that up. If a client is not willing to put in the effort to improve themselves and their mental health, then I am also not willing to put in the effort. I put in as much effort for my client as they are willing to put in for themselves.
Understand. On the other hand, there are people who are so damaged and falling to pieces, emotionally bereft, for want of a better word. Sometimes all they need is an audience for that, a concerned listener on a repeated basis. But there is a there tell me if I have this right, and I've read a whole bunch of psychology books, and I've had multiple therapists that I've worked with, and I've also read Hands, as the therapist is the one who gave me the client, and I'm doing the reading with the therapist presence, so like that. But at a certain point, the person is asked to do at the appropriate time, an action is offered.
Well, so Richard, you have to consider that if somebody is having a really tough time and they're very damaged, then they took a huge action step to show up at therapy. That's a big action. So
You
it's
mean
not like I'm saying you have to.
you don't just parachute into their home and tell them you should talk
No,
to me.
I got in trouble for doing that, so I don't do it anymore.
Okay.
No, but yeah, so it's about breaking it down to the smallest step, and an action is definitely showing up for therapy. Sometimes that's too hard to do.
So there's by the way, there's an overlap with hand reading, although it's not exactly the same. On the one hand, you're the empathetic listener and you're a trained listener. You're more than just a shoulder to cry on. You
Trained
have,
and experienced.
I was just going to say, you have training and experience. And your role is not to be their pal, although you might have pal-ness in your toolkit. And there's a similar, I don't know, balance. I'm not sure if that's the correct word, but there's a similar duality in hand reading. On the one hand, I want to be supportive. You at your best. I can see a picture in your hands of what you at your best looks like. I could see you at your next to the very best, which isn't so bad. And maybe you've spent time here. I don't know. You can tell me if you want. So there's the supportive, aren't you good? Look at how, let me applaud your everythingness. And I'm not staying there in a reading, though. Oh, and by the way, we'll be getting to the obstacle course that you're involved in and what. How your skill set works best and doesn't work best. We'll be getting to that shortly. But let me tell you one more thing that I think that's really cool about you first. I do consider it my job to observe, visit, and communicate about, that means talking and listening about both sides of that coin. And there's a decent chance that I'm seeing this person one time. And that's a very different contract than you have. But also, you've been a hand reader when your contract was see them once. Can you talk about the difference then? Are you happier to see them multiple times? Because you know you don't have to get everywhere right now.
Yeah, I feel like I'm able to help people. So, okay, as a hand reader, I can very specifically talk to the person about what their challenges are going to be and, where they can find the most strength in themselves and how they can channel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I can't help them do it. I can tell them the information that I see. I can give them advice. I can make suggestions. I can do all of that stuff. But then after the 90 minutes, bye, good luck in life. Whereas now I can let the person organically show me what's going on. I know, but I can let them organically display how it shows up for them. And I have the time to help them. So I have the time for the action and accountability stuff. And I have the time to walk with them while they're making those tiny little steps toward goals.
Yeah, that reminds me, you know what I'm going to say next, of course. That reminds me of why I became a scuba diver. That's
Oh, I
exactly
knew that. Of course.
that's what you were expecting me to say, I'm sure of it.
Exact. Of
Right.
course.
So I'm snorkeling and there's the beautiful coral reef, et cetera, and I'm enjoying myself. And the coral reef is maybe 20, 25 feet down from where I am. At the surface, and that's too far for me to do anything to get close to it. And then a couple of scuba divers, they just float right down and they're like pointing to things that I'm looking at from 20 feet away. And so I do a little diving thing and I get down and I could stay under like what, 2/10 of a second before I pop up for air. And I decided to learn how to do that so I could travel differently and stay there longer. It's kind of like you being a therapist. I don't know if you get the it's same thing.
I became a therapist so I could look at coral reef.
But the disappearing coral reefs. You'll be out
Well,
of, that brings up you're going to be out of therapy clients soon as everybody on the planet gets their act together.
Right. It's
Right.
a big worry for me.
So I have a list here. So action and accountability. I have a list.
You have
And
a list.
There is my topic that I listed here is a question of ownership. And you've heard me teach this in classes that you've attended with me as well, which is under the title of Dialogue Disguise Ears. I'm listening to what my client is saying. I'm also staring at their hands or their handprints. And I see, again, I could see exactly what they look like at their best. And I see if they're at their best, what they had to go through, what they had to learn, what they had to experience in order to become the man or woman that I'm describing. And if they're not there, I could see what the snaggle points would be. So I'm listening to, let's use Mary again. I'm listening to Mary, and she's telling me how she can't do X because, well, as you know, it's Aunt Matilda and the needs to help her prune her fig tree. And if it weren't for Aunt Matilda's fig tree, she definitely would have done X with her life. And I'm exaggerating, but as you know, only slightly exaggerating to make my point. In that statement by my client, there is a complete lack of ownership of how they're in the circumstance they're in. It's as if they were dropped from an airplane into this life. They know nothing about how they got here. They're not responsible any at any level for the condition of their life as it is.
Right. None of the choices that they made led to this.
So do you encounter this in your therapy office?
Oh,
And
of
I'm
course.
assuming, of course, you do. So what do you do about that? Can you tell me more? Here, but please feel comfortable. Tell me more. It's a safe environment. Tell me more.
I say, tell me everything. Right. So, how do I take it? I get curious. So, I don't use, like, well, in this example, I wouldn't say, well, you are the one that chose to go to your Aunt Matilda's house, and you are the one that decided that that alarm you set for yourself doesn't matter.
So you don't use the anvil drop from 20 feet approach? You
No,
don't
I
use it
also
as
got in
much.
trouble for that.
You don't use it as often as you used to.
Right. Washington State has a complaint line. No, but get curious. And that looks more like, what do you think would have happened if you'd have told your Aunt Matilda that you couldn't come today? You know, and I wonder, you know, what do you think would happen if you'd have made this choice? And eventually, and it might not happen in the same session, but eventually, if I wa can walk a client back far enough, most of the time they can get to the place where they made the conscious decision that led them in this direction. Most of the time. But it does take some walking back.
So, what I might do that's slightly different from you. I would I'm more like a palmistry lawyer slash lawyer person. They've just lied on the stand in my
And you
analogy.
say you can't handle
No,
the
I don't do that. No, I don't. No, I might ask them to tell me more. I might encourage them to take the lie further.
Oh,
Oh.
yeah.
Yeah. So then, and it was like other times with your aunt and this and that. And that could relate to the other thing that what we were talking about just before, where you can't because of your aunt. I would encourage them to, build the corner that they're going to paint
So
themselves. too.
So you do the method of give them enough rope to hang themselves.
Well, I want more information to come back and address that issue. I want to agree, well, this is, we're dealing with resistance, correct?
Yeah.
Right. Is there anything written in psychology manuals about dealing with resistance?
There's a paragraph here and there.
I just, and you know, I've written extensively on this and talked about
yes, you absolutely
extensively as well. But we're not getting where we're going without bumping into your resistance factor. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. If absolutely. Things go well, we're going to bump right up against the guardian. The guardian has like a white t-shirt, like Mr. Clean or something, this guy. if you're
you
just
the
audio, I'm putting one arm on top of the other at my chin level, and they're parallel to the ground. And I look like, what would that be? Somebody who's guarding a gate in like an ancient Siam or something.
You're making me think of the British guards who stand there with their floofy hats on and are very stoic.
Yeah, like that. But I like the tall, muscular, white t-shirt look.
You go for the bald and big look.
Bald so and built. So do you, since you married somebody like that.
I did.
In any event, this is the guardian who stands guard. They're a guardian. Mm-hmm. They stand guard over, and what's on the other side that you're not supposed to get to is whatever it is that needs protection. And it would be good. I don't know. Some readings, I don't get that far at all because the person really doesn't open up, offer permission to go further into topics I talk about, which, okay, some readings are like that. Other people I see multiple times like you do, on an ongoing basis. Again, not therapy. It's a different relationship that I have and a different permission structure. But sooner or later, we're bumping up against the guardian, the resistance guardian. And as a matter of fact, you know that I also have exercises with students. The purpose of the exercise is to get the guardian to show herself.
Yeah. So we are doing the same thing, but we're using it differently. So you're inviting them to continue telling you more about this fabrication they've made up.
Well, that's a starting point.
Right. And what I'm doing is similar in that I'm asking them for conjecture about what would happen if they did what the guardian didn't want them to do. Mm-hmm. And that gets the guardian to show up as well, because then the guardian says, oh, no, you're not passing. And here's why.
So it would be very good in a shamanic exercise. You know, I like those type of exercise. Mm-hmm. If you can bump up against your guardian and interview her. Mm-hmm. Or if you could paint her, collage her, do other types of exercises to exploit the fact of her resistance without going into a self-blame story for the existence of your guardian. Instead, I'm excited to find her. She's mm-hmm. been here all along. Obviously, a construct designed to protect me in some very important way. How exciting to bump into her. That's not an easy frame of mind to bump into your resistance with.
Well, especially, Richard, because those guardians were probably put in place when you were a toddler.
Yes.
And so they have, the guardians have somewhat of a perspective of a scared little kid.
I would edit, since I'm busy in my editing mode this week, Alana and I doing editing on Hand Analysis 102. Yeah. So I would take out the kind of. In this version of things, and by the way, in your therapist training, did you have to do, you've done a lot of workshops with me where all the students had to do exercises, talk in pair chairings, talk to the entire group about self-discovery exercises. And there was surrender skills at a premium requirement. The whole point was to allow whatever was there to show itself, emerge, and see if you can be in the presence of this scared moment in time. Can you hold yourself in high regard for arriving here? Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, you know my axioms of soul psychology based upon fingerprint analysis. You have a life purpose and a life lesson, and your life purpose, which is where your greatest meaning can be found, already printed in your fingerprints prior to birth. The access to that is by going through your life lesson. So bumping into your life lesson and being able to consider it your ally, embrace the moment, feel whatever you feel, but don't run away and make up a bacchata story about that. You know, your Yiddish. Exactly. That's the essential skill set necessary to unlock your life of meaning. And that's a very different form of action and accountability. It's a soul psychology level of action and accountability. And then there's the other accountability. You ever do things with people and they don't do what they say they're going to do, and you're left standing in the rain?
Oh my gosh, yes.
In the cold, in the rain, at midnight in Georgia or something. Didn't she leave you at the train in the rain?
On the midnight train to Georgia?
Uh-huh.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Or something like that. Well, what do you do? Okay, so I was just talking on a more shamanic, spiritual level of accountability. And I'd like to get there in readings if I can get there. I'd like to get there in coaching with my students if permission is granted. But there's another type of action and accountability, or the non-accountability of people who they just don't do what they say they're going to do. And the penalty for that falls on your shoulders, not theirs. Ah, how often have you been part of that story? I've been in that story and I don't like it.
Mm-hmm. That's not a dynamic that I have in therapy. Because I'm not relying on my clients to do something, or else I end up holding the bag.
Well, what if your client, let's call this Bob now, we get Mary. Oh. She's done enough already.
Mary's a hot mess. Let's move on.
We're with Bob. So Bob is working at Fred's farm, and they've been working together for years, except that Fred is the owner of the farm. Bob gets a salary. And if the value of the farm goes up, that accrues to Fred, not Bob. But Fred has to leave for a family emergency. He's going to be gone a month. He leaves the harvesting to Bob, who goes on a bender and doesn't harvest any of the crops because he was drunk for a month, in my story. This is an exaggerated scenario. And then Fred comes back and says, the crops, they're stuck in the field. You know, I'm ruined. You know, I have loans. I have to pay them whether we have a harvest or not. I'm going to lose the farm that's been in my family for umpteen generations. And I thought you were my friend. Well, yeah, I was your friend. I feel bad about it. I feel really bad about it, says Bob. You know, I just feel bad about it. And I'm just going to blame myself for the next, who knows, 100 years. Mm-hmm. But it's Fred who loses the farm.
Right.
You don't have, you don't get either Bob or Fred in your therapy office?
I get Bob and Fred in my therapy office. Absolutely.
I was thinking, by the way, this can also be a married couple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's action and accountability, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well,
was feeling bad good enough if it was Bob who screwed up? So he really feels bad. Is that enough?
No, that's like, I would say, well, cool story. That's nice that you feel bad.
Yeah, thank you. But, thanks for sharing.
Right. But what I would want from Bob would be, I totally let you down. I got super drunk. I don't know how I'm going to fix it, but I am going to fix it. And I'm going to try to get you the money that you need, or something along those lines. Even just own it. I'm sorry is not owning it. I'm sorry is
Thoughts and prayers for
application.
thoughts and prayers for the 20 children killed in your school.
Right. You're in my prayers at dinner. Yeah, no. I'm sorry is not accountable. Accountability is acknowledging what you did to the other person and owning what you did, not just what, being sorry for it.
So you've heard me also say this one. My first therapist ever, Anne, who left the planet years ago at this point, she famous to me, told me, Richard, you think if you could beat yourself up enough, you don't have to change.
You've told me that a million times. If you can stay in the victim role, you don't have to change.
Right. So why is it that people don't want to change? I mean, there they are banging their head against the wall with this big bleeding lump appearing on their head, and they don't want to stop that behavior?
Yeah, it's different in therapy than in hand reading. Because in hand reading, you can point it out, but in therapy, I'll just blatantly say, literally, so you've cast yourself pretty solidly in the victim role. How's that going for you? You know, I just get curious.
And what kind of responses do you get? Do people go, that's why I'm here, help me out? Do people go, now you're victimizing me, I'm going to sue you? What do people do with that?
Well, first of all, I read the room. I'm not going to say that to somebody who's going to sue me if I do it.
Oh.
But no, okay.
Aren't
I
you
get
smart
very,
for that?
I went to therapy school. They train you. No, if somebody says, people at that point, if I'm going to call somebody out like that, they're not going to, they already know the gig is up. They're not going to bullshit anymore. And if they do, because they know if they do, I'll say, okay, that's a load of shit. Let's try again. You know? And I do say that kind of stuff.
Oh, you don't say that in a hand reading though, do you? I
no.
don't.
I would,
I do.
I would
do
not.
Not. No,
the permission structure is not the same.
No, that brings up an interesting point. Thank you for using that phrase, permission structure. A hand reading is a very different thing than therapy. And unless they say at the outset they want to see me a number of times in a row, in general, my permission structure is for this session, for these 90 minutes. If we decide to go further, that's a separate agreement to go further. And I'm instructing my students, as you no doubt recall, and it's good to remind myself as well, to check in with my client as to what permission structure I have moving forward. And it's not the same contract to have a hand reading. It isn't therapy. I am permitted to tell them, you know, this is the wrong job for you from what I see in your hand. And you might not do that as a therapist or a life coach or something else. I do that all the time with people. This doesn't fit you. I mean, you're good at it, but it's not getting you anywhere. Would you agree? I can do that in a hand reading. Therapy is different. But if I'm going to, I see all sorts of stuff in people's hands that I don't talk about. I'm not their therapist. But I do ask repeatedly, should I go on? Would you like to look more at this? Is it clear enough as to how I described it? Can you use this information? Should we dive into it further? I need to do that umpteen times during a hand reading. That's 90 minutes. I need to do that at least every 10 minutes or so as I move along.
You know, Richard, I do that too, maybe not every 10 minutes. And I do have more permission for some things, although I wouldn't be directive as much as to say, this is the wrong job. Oh, maybe I would. Or maybe I would more say something like, how do you feel about this job? Is this a good fit for you?
Mm-hmm.
But I do ask, I'll say like, I have a question. Is it okay to ask? Or I say, I'd like to make an observation. is that okay with you? And most of the time my clients know, oh no, here it comes.
What, how did I screw up now?
Right. I'd like to make an observation. It's kind of like your wife saying, can we talk?
Which lie am I going to have to defend? Okay. So exactly. I have notes here. I have literal notes. You can't see my notes, by the way.
I'll try not to look over your shoulder.
So, and I have a final bullet point with an emphasis on the irony factor. And the title is Action and Accountability. And I've read the hands of umpteen, I think that's the exact number, umpteen people who are using responsibility and accountability as a hiding place. They're the responsible ones. The spouses of these people are the problem. Or they have to work at the family business because who knows why, because grandma's 99 and you know they need me there to help grandma do it. And I would be living my life. I would be owning my life experience. I'm not saying the way they talk it. I would be living my life purpose, which you identified properly. Thank you for my hand. I would be doing that optimal life of mine, but I can't because I'm busy being responsible.
Meh, that's just another excuse to stay in victim.
Well, yeah, but that is that what you're going to say to them? You've seen
this. No, I'd probably say something like, and how is that serving you?
Yeah. So you've seen this in therapy, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
I know Absolutely. You've seen it in hand readings. Mm-hmm. Do anything? Can you? You have a different seat than me. You've had both hats on. Where you know I have the one hat, and you're a two hat owner. So do you do that? Do you deal with that? First of all, you agree that responsibility can be used as a hiding place?
Sure. Workaholics, a lot of times workaholic because they're avoiding other stuff. They're real responsible about their job, but it's in an effort to avoid living life or taking ownership for
Or what's going somebody, on. You know, excuse me, or carrying your piano uphill in the snow both ways over and over again. I'm the also responsible one while you are gallivanting around.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's also a dance of being careful about confrontation versus consideration. And so I might not say, and how's that serving you? But I might say something like, is there a world out there somewhere in which you do less and live more? And then get the clients. And again, if I take out the direct, we're talking about you and you need to have the right answer. Is there a world out there? Is there another universe where you do less and you live more? What do you think that looks like? So around the edges, I get into, you know, I'll have my client describe what it might look like if they took more ownership. And then I say, you know, maybe that sounds nice. You want to work toward that.
Mm. And I might use a baby step mm-hmm. approach. First, I would agree. I like to agree with the resistance first, you know, mm-hmm. my tactic there. And then I might even add to it. And you're not just carrying the piano uphill both ways, but the stool. Oh, yeah.
You have the stool hooked onto your belt trying to drive you backwards.
And, you know, balancing that on top of the piano is not mm-hmm. the good thing. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But I might ask people, what 5% less? We're not saying that you should, but can you tell me what 5% less of this could be? Not that you should do 5% less. Can you describe what 5% less would be?
I'm not suggesting that you reduce it by 5%. Far be it for me.
I'm just a humble hand reader here. You hired me to dissect your life and hand it back to you with a better knowledge of how your parts work. Let me use this as a pull it together ribbon and bow. Sure. On top. In a hand reading, when I describe problematic behaviors, I'm usually describing them not so much as a function of you, my client, screwing up. You know, given the equipment package that I've been describing for the last 20 minutes, and it has all those pluses that I've told you about, when operating negatively, when not in efficient mode, and there's nobody who's going to be in efficient mode all the time, I can describe what your non-efficient mode is. And that's what we've been talking about for here the last 10 minutes or so. You're not escaping your life movie without landing on that square on your game board sometimes. If you get stuck on that square for decades, that's a different story. But you're not doing this sometimes. So
Right.
what's your coping mechanism? What have you developed as a way to break out of this? Because we can also expect, you know, again, given the structure of who you are and the parts available to you, that's not the last time you're going to land on this square on your game board. You know, what's your coping mechanism for this? And can you land on that square again without tearing you to shreds for landing there? Anybody built like you is going to land on that square and behave that way sometimes. How not?
And can we update the guardian that's guarding that square to know that you're now 45 and not two?
Thank you for seeing me as 45. You were talking to
Richard, don't look a day over 45.
me. I think this is a good spot to end our call.
On that high note,
Yeah, on
you
that
should
high note.
stop recording now.
Thank you. Well, let me thank
Yeah, let's.
everybody who, you know, whoever they may be, for dropping in and listening. And I'll leave you with a question about your own action and accountability. How do you feel you're doing? And regardless of your performance of keeping your word, doing what you said you're going to do, et cetera, and keeping one's word and doing what you said you're going to do are important things. Can you be kind to yourself as you explore this part of you? Can you give yourself some leeway, like you would if you were, well, one hopes if you were a school teacher and your third graders were screwing up at the, on their assignments? Can you have that smile? Isn't that the smile you have? I've seen that smile before, Robin, when your dogs are not doing what they're supposed to do. Isn't that the look that goes on your face first? That's
Yes,
so cute.
exactly.
And do they have proper accountability?
They're dogs. They let me pet them, and I guess that makes up for it. They permit me, so gracious of them.
And they love on you.
They do love on me, and that makes it all worth it.
It is. Okay, so thanks for the call, Robin.
Yeah, thanks, Richard.